Hollywood is rated LGBT radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Welcome, welcome, welcome to this installment of Rated LGBT Radio. Today we have a really wonderful show lined up for you. We are looking at a brand new film, one you probably haven't heard of yet because it is making its U.S. premiere at film festivals around the country. The film is called Toll, as in Toll Road. It is a Brazilian film and really captures an environment in Brazil that is full of homophobia and the whole idea of quote-unquote reparative therapy. It is a tight, well-done drama. The filmmaker, Carolina Mankiewicz, is here with us today, as is the film star, Maeve Jenkins. And both are award-winning artists in their own right. So we're really excited to talk to them about this. The film, the main character, played by Maeve, is a toll booth attendant, and she realizes she can use her job to raise some extra money illegally. But this is only for a so-called noble cause, because she wants to send her son to an expensive gay conversion workshop led by a renowned foreign priest. And the film is kind of a little bit dark. It has humor in it. It is incredibly well acted and a really great script. Very intimate and thought-provoking and moving. So excited to talk to them about that. First, though, we're going to go to Brody Levesque with the current news of the day. Brody is the executive editor of the Los Angeles Blade magazine, as well as being producer and co-host of this show. The LA Blade is the newspaper you want to read every single day for first-rate journalism, reporting on the LGBTQ interest. And you can find that at LosAngelesBlade.com. But first, here is Brody with what's going on today. Hey, Brody.
Hey, Rob. I have a couple of pieces for our listeners today. The Gallup poll released the results of its latest survey, and the survey found that LGBTQ plus identification among adults in the U.S. continues to grow, with 7.6% of the total population now identifying as lesbian, gay, bi, trans, queer, or another sexual orientation besides heterosexual. Now, this polling figure is up from 5.6%, which was the Gallup poll taken 4 years ago. And interestingly enough, nearly double what the poll showed in 2012, which was the very first year that Gallup actually did this poll, and the results showed 3.5% of the population. Unsurprisingly, in taking the poll and working with the poll, Gallup pollsters found that increases in LGBTQ identification have occurred as members of Gen Z and the millennials have entered adulthood. Adults in these younger generations are far more likely than in the older generations to identify as LGBTQ+. So overall, the researchers at Gallup reported that each younger generation is about twice as likely as the generation that preceded it to identify as LGBTQ+. According to the results of the poll, which was done at the end of 2023, more than one in five Gen Z adults ranging in age 18 to 26 identified as LGBTQ+. And one in 10 millennials. Now, millennials are age 27 to 42. These percentages drop considerably when we start talking about Gen X and, of course, the baby boomers. And now 1% of what we call the silent generation, or as my colleague Tom Brokaw called them, America's greatest generation. So we're looking at that for Gallup. If you want to go read the full results of the poll, go to losangelesplay.com. The Gallup poll at the end of my story there, you'll see a link that will take you directly to the Gallup poll. Speaking of the queer community writ large, I'm going to reflect for just a moment. We had a loss this week, an iconic LGBTQ AIDS activist and political strategist, David Mixner, passed away at age 77 in New York. I had interviewed David numerous times over the years, actually going back to a time during the Clinton administration when I was working for Reuters in Washington. And I believe that was the first time I actually had ever interviewed David. David and I had kept in touch over the years. Mixner was a longtime formidable presence, both in Democratic circles and, of course, within the LGBTQ community. This is someone who virtually knew everyone, and he's one of the people that was able to do so much good for the community. Among several of the accolades that you could give David, he founded the LGBTQ Victory Fund. The purpose, of course, of the Victory Fund was to get queer candidates elected to office as something that was its mission, continues to be its mission, and did, you know, an amazing job. In the early days of the gay movement in Los Angeles, David and two of his people founded the Municipal Elections Committee of LA, MECLA, and it really became the first gay and lesbian political action committee. After that, David was very much active in the fight to kill California's Prop 6, also known as the Briggs Initiative, which would have prevented or actually fired anybody who identified as gay or lesbian from teaching in California public schools. David was instrumental in moving the public against this measure, especially in Southern California, where he was based. But he also partnered with legendary San Francisco politician and later supervisor, the late Harvey Milk. So that was another one of the initiatives. When I met David in 92, he was supporting Bill Clinton's campaign for president. And one of the things that happened out of that was Clinton had made certain promises to David and some of the other activists about queer military service. He reneged on it and walked it back and produced what later became known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which was not, as far as the queer community was concerned, advancing, you know, military service at all. And it was an onerous compromise. And that caused David to actually break with not only just Clinton, but a lot of the Democrats. It was a huge public fight at the time, but Mixner, you know, David persevered. He went on to do other things, past Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It was interesting that when we were talking about the appeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in an interview I had with David, and this was as it was being considered by Congress, David reflected to me that he thought that, you know, it took that long to get everybody to move the ball down the court, and yet here we were, but he was glad to see it. Of course, President Barack Obama in 2011 signed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And then, you know, for all of us, I think it was kind of a reflective victory, but more so because David had been one of the early influential people that was moving forward on it. David has also been praised for his role as an AIDS activist for many, many years. The amount of money that Mixner and his friends raised was incredible. He was actually part of one of the very first national HIV/AIDS protests outside the White House during the Reagan administration. And he was actually among more of the 60 protesters that were arrested many of whom, of course, were in the ACT UP organization. David was the type of person that he would put an all-in effort. In New York, we have a very fine center, which Carl has been a guest on our show, the L.A. Forney Center in New York. David was massively instrumental in making sure that Carl and the folks at L.A. Forney Center got necessary funding. He hosted countless fundraisers for the center. He was just an important part of it. David will be remembered on March 25th at 10 a.m. at the Church of St. Paul the Apostle, which is at 405 West 59th Street in New York. So if you're in Manhattan or in the tri-state and you want to honor David, his funeral services, again, will be held at 10 in the morning on the 25th of this month at Church of St. Paul the Apostle, again, and that's at 405 West 59th in the city of New York. So we say goodbye to David, a legendary part of our community, and probably without doubt an activist, you know, par excellence and extraordinaire. Taking a look around, it's interesting that, you know, as we go through and we're reporting on different things, and of course now a lot of our focus is on our trans brothers and sisters and some of the fights and things that are going on there. You know, I think of David and I think of all the early work in the movement ground and a lot of the foundational things that we're seeing. It was really David and people like him that, you know, really laid the groundwork for what later, you know, became such a critical component of, you know, the movement for queer rights above and beyond marriage equality. So there you go. That's my two highlights for the week, Rob.
Okay, great. Thanks, Brody. And with that, I want to bring on Carolina. Carolina has written and directed six short films, which were selected for more than 300 festivals and the recipients of many awards. The Orphan is her most recognized film, which premiered at the Cannes Director Fortnight in 2018, and it won the Queer Palm. Her debut feature was a film called Charcoal. It premiered in competition at the Toronto International Film Festival and made the European premiere at San Sebastian International Film Festival in 2022. Her current film is called Toll. It is a brilliant film, and we are going to talk to her about that right now. So, Carolina, welcome to the show.
Hello, Robbie. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for your kind words.
Oh, well, your film is so intense and dramatic and moving. I want to take you back a little bit, though, because obviously the theme of homophobia is a very big one in the film, and you grew up in kind of the countryside of Brazil. What is the attitude about gay people and LGBTQ people in that environment that you grew up in?
Well, I think it's very, the countryside of São Paulo, the city where I grew up, it's very conservative. And I think pretty much the relation between, you know, how homosexuals are seen and treated in this kind of places is something quite disturbing, because sometimes, you know, they dispose, you know, all the shame and all the, as if it was something, as if it was a disease, as if it's something that is supposed to be cured, and even, you know, things that are actually people that, you know, do things that are illegal. They sometimes it's bizarre because I have this story of this mother that I knew there, and she has a son who was convicted as a drug dealer, and a son who was gay, and she always said that she's spoke with the one that was, you know, convicted, but not with the gay one. You know, so I always say that when in conservative places, sometimes to be from the LGBT community and to be gay, I mean, it's like something wrong. It's bizarre, and the idea of the film came, you know, to try to understand, to try to discuss more about this.
Yeah, no. And what was your experience growing up in that environment, both from dealing with those kind of attitudes, but also what was your drive to become a filmmaker?
Well, actually, I was a kid. I was growing up. I was, you know, still growing myself. I mean, personally, as a human being, I still didn't know what I was and, you know, things like that. But it was so crazy to grow up in a countryside and feel this kind of surveillance of the social performance that you are supposed to have, like you should get married, you should have kids and things like that. And I actually... And people, most of the times, they are not where they perform socially, you know, like, you know, marriages that, you know, people don't even enjoy the company of each other. This is very common, right? Yeah. Especially in places where people are supposed to fit in some roles. And this always was something that gave me a lot of curiosity, and so I think I'm not a filmmaker because of that, but this trial to kind of understand why things are like that and why the religion, you know, like bases a lot in Brazil, and it's so strong, and, you know, it kind of justifies everything, and it's the reason and the main goal to everything, especially, I mean, in Brazil, in conservative places. It made me try to investigate that, and I always been in love with films, and so it started like that, I think.
Yeah, it's and a lot of the themes that you just mentioned are, you know, I see those in Toll. I mean, there's that comes out very strongly. Although while I say that it comes out strongly, it's also so brilliantly written or weaved into the fabric of the film that you don't feel like it's being preached at you, or that you're making it super obvious, but it is completely organic and evident in the characters within the film. The movie is very character-driven, as I detect are all the films that you've made. Why and how is that your perspective when you address a storyline?
Thanks so much. Well, I totally agree that the movie is totally character-driven. I think the most important for me is people and places they live, they grow, and how each one kind of inflicts in each other, people and the environment, you know. So my films are always very focused on that, how the cities, the society can, you know, influence in people's life and vice versa. I think this is, everything is created according to this energy, let's say like that. I mean, the visuals, the way that I decide to shoot, the way that I made my choices as a filmmaker is according to this plot and to how the characters feel.
And the two stars of the film both turn in absolutely brilliant, intimate performances in the movie. And, I mean, I'm assuming, and I know you have Maeve right there, but I'm assuming that a lot of that they brought to the table themselves, because obviously Maeve on her own is a awarded actress in other projects, so obviously she brings that to the table automatically. But what is your method of working with the actors? Because across the whole film, the performances are all you know, right on target. What is your method as a director for pulling that out of an actor?
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, I think what you said is precisely the truth. You know, they bring a lot to the table. I think the most, maybe the first and the most important thing for a director to work with actor is choosing, you know, not doing the right choice, you know, choosing the right actress or actor for that role, or the person that understands the you know, the tone of the film, that, you know, can dive into the tone. And I think both Maeve and Cowan had, you know, that had that very precisely inside of them. I had worked before with both of them, and I think this mix of a new actor or almost a known actor with a very experienced, very, like you said, award-winning, very experienced and talented actress, it was something that was important to both of them, you know, because she would teach him and he would teach her in another point as well, you know, because the character was very close to his real life. So we rehearsed a lot, but I never give the screenplay to young actors. So Maeve knew the screenplay pretty well, but Kawa didn't. So we do like this mix, you know, between the more technical rehearsals with things that are more improvised, and it's a whole world to create this universe. And yes, as you said,
wow.
Yes, Maeve right here beside me.
Yeah, and did you write when you wrote the script for Toll? Did you have them? You, like you said, you've worked with each of them in other films previous to this, and in fact, Maeve was in your other feature film, the lead of your other feature film. Did you write Toll with her and with Kin in mind?
I did, actually. I did. I had this thing in my mind that she starred in Charcoal, my first film, and I actually didn't want to have the same main actress for the main, you know, for the main character. But at the same point, I was with her in my mind, and I couldn't take it out. So I told her exactly this, and I sent her the screenplay, and she really liked the screenplay. She was like, I don't mind doing with the same director. She was kidding, and we were like, okay, so I can't see the film without you, and let's go. And, well, she's an amazing actress, and I always, when I'm writing, I have some image of who will be in the character in my head. Sometimes, of course, it turns out not to be that person, but I did always have her and Kawan in this case in my mind while writing, you know, during all the time of the writing.
Oh, brilliant. And if Maeve is there, I'd love to ask her a question in terms of, Maeve, what
just one second.
Backstory?
I'm going to pass.
Okay.
I'm going to pass her. One second.
Hey, Rob.
Hey, Maeve. Welcome to the show, and congratulations on such a brilliant performance in Toll. You just so moving. So, oh my God, it was just so on point. What was your feelings about addressing that character? And what kind of backstory in your mind did you build around her?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting us. And I would like to say hi to all the audience. It's a pleasure to be in such a well-spoken podcast. I've heard a lot of good things about the podcast. So thank you for having us here.
Our pleasure.
Well, it was... you know, as you were talking with Carolina before, we did these two features together, and I was trying to understand her language, her aesthetic. You know, this dangerous mixing between the human dramas and also this kind of acid humor, which was kind of new for me, and so. This was a point very, very precious for me, actually, very new for me, and challenging as well, of course. And in Toll, I have this, you know, homophobic mother, and I am from LGBT community, and even if I wouldn't, I'm pretty sure as a progressive left-wing woman, I would be empathetic to this point. So, but anyway, it was a huge challenge to play this character without judging it. Judging her,
right.
And my main point in the beginning was to find her humanity and her pain, because when I started to interview mothers who were actually dealing with this conflict, internal conflict, I saw a lot of pain. Rob, you know, was kind of they were. Being not allowed to love their kids as they were, you know, and they were suffering, actually. So when I realized that, it was so much easier to villainize this woman. So I realized that the main point was to find all the pressure that were coming from the society, from the, you know, from the work environment, the WhatsApp groups, you know, all the judgmental gaze from the society pressuring her as a, especially being a single mother, you know, from a lower class, having this black son, which she knows that. And statistically speaking, he would be less chances in society. She knows that.
Mm-hmm.
So, in her point of view, I think, which and this was very important for me to understand, she was just trying to fix it, fix something that she learned that was just not right, and I. Think it was important for me as well to understand that, and actually I thought it was very smart from Carolina to put in this in the script and this character that this conservative ideology was not coming necessarily from Swelling. She's not that conservative. She's pretty much open mind.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes she uses that, you know, little shorts, and she has her boyfriend, and she, but she's a normative woman, and especially she knows that in some ways she needs to fit in society to have more chances, you know, as a woman, as a single mother, and especially to teach her son in her mind, you know. So it was a challenge for me to have all this point, all her points in my mind as an actress, although I don't agree
right.
with them.
But you know, it's your portrayal was so on target, because watching it, I never felt like you were symbolizing a homophobic mother. It was like you were so much Sue Ellen. It was so much organic from her. And her reaction, and to your point, there's a point where, I don't want to give away too many details, but you know, there's a point where she sees her friend doing something shocking based on what her own perception of her friend would be, and she's very forgiving around that. It's sort of like, oh, well, that's strange that you would do that, but okay. You know, it's, I mean, her attitude, you know, was much more forgiving of that. And I want to ask both you and or Carolina about the conversion therapy sessions mm-hmm. that are in the film. Are those based on real practices you guys have heard of in Brazil, or were they more imaginative? What was that program based on?
They are completely imaginative. You know, Carolina decided to not, let's say, to not repeat the violence that the LGBT community has in our real lives. she doesn't. She decided not to repeat this in the screen, you know. So she preferred to appoint the ridiculousness in this called conversion ritual, which is there's nothing to convert. But she decided to put the ridiculousness in the in this point. But so she researched a lot about this conversion rituals, but which in reality they have a lot of violence and physically and
mm-hmm.
Psychologists speaking. But she decided to create her own conversion ritual, you know. So and also she uses a lot this which all the religions has a lot, this strong performance, you know. It's very theatrical, all the religions are actually, but she chose to I think she was very smart in this point as well, because you know a lot of persons says that it was very unexpectable, you know. Even the clothes of this, which is not a priest, actually, it's a pastor. I don't know if you call the same here, pastor.
Priest is generally, at least in the United States, is generally regarded for a Catholic.
Catholic
priest,
yeah,
and then minister, preacher, yeah, are the Protestant versions of that, which that would be more accurate. Yeah,
I love the point that Carolina uses in this performance from this pastor, a lot of elements and kind of performance that we actually have right now in Brazilian politics, you know. Even in the Congress, we have a lot of politics doing this kind of performance in public. And I think that I dare to say that we nowadays are having conversion rituals and in a large scale, you know, as Brazilians, as a nation. And she uses this sort of performance in the scenes from the conversion in the film. And instead of having the violence, you know, the real violence.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a way to allow us as the LGBT community as well to see the ridiculousness and also laugh. I remember feeling very healing, you know, Rob, to allowing me to laugh in this situation, but now laughing not about ourselves, but laughing about how ridiculousness is this idea of conversion, you know.
Yeah, it's. I mean, and the way it plays out in the film is very authentic, because quite frankly, I've heard of many different practices within quote unquote conversion therapy that are absolutely equally as ridiculous. You know, it's like, so there's, it's not like that, the invention of the fact that it is a ridiculous endeavor. And to your point, it's like, quite frankly, a lot of the conversion therapies, because, and I've written articles about this, where the people who are involved in these conversion therapies, at least in the United States, are often mm-hmm. people who claim that they have been converted themselves. And mm-hmm. in that umbrella where they're pretending they were converted, they're not, and they use the exercises within the conversion therapy to actually physically abuse the people they're supposedly converting. It's very, you know, really graphically evil, and much more so than than is portrayed in your film. I did want to ask you about one other part of the film, and from your perspective as the actress involved in it. And there's a scene where the police burst into your home, and I won't give away why they do that. And your son...
No spoilers.
yeah, no spoilers. Your son, who's black, is very belligerent with them. And from my perspective with Black Lives Matter and all the things that have been happening here in the United States, I was absolutely terrified as, you know, putting myself in a parental role. Your character seemed to do that as well in the scene where it was like all she was concerned with was shut up, you know, stop, you know, getting in their face. Was that going through your mind in that, in playing that, or what, how did that scene transpire for you?
That's an amazing point. Thank you for this question. Actually, it's the first time I hear this question, and so it was so organic because and a strong memory because I remember that, you know, I used to rehearse sometimes with Kawan's mother help. Sometimes I called her to help me with the script and to put the words in my mouth. And sometimes she said to me, Maeve, you're being too sweet with him. You have to be more tough with him. And so she allowed me to be his mother on the set, you know. And I couldn't forget that he's a teenager, he's a young boy, he's and he's a black boy, and a very violent world with. Statistically speaking, again, we know that there is a lot of violence, and most of the murders are exactly with young black men. So I was in panic, but we didn't plan it to do that way. Kawan was playing perfectly, and when he was being, you know, out of his head, he was how can I say, too violent when the policeman, and I didn't plan to do that, but that's I thought that at that moment that I had to shut out him because I was in panic that, I don't know, I was afraid that they could give him a shot, you know, could shot on him.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
It was very natural and organic, and I could see on at him at that moment. He was surprised, you know, but he never got out of the character, you know. He was...
No,
He kept going, and you know, and we, and it was strong. We did that shot maybe three times. I don't know. I don't remember actually, but that shot was the best, definitely, because it was so natural and organic. We were really afraid of that policeman, and because that shot was the shot that Kawan was more violent with them as well, so I was really scared.
There was so much that happened in that scene, at least for me watching it, was one, it was one of the biggest scenes where I totally got empathetic with your character. You know, it's like there was no, you know, because as a parent myself, it's like that would have been exactly my reaction with you know, my son, you know, going off. And it's like, you know, all I care about is you being safe. That's all I care about in this situation. You know, everything else go away. And, you know,
it came out so beautifully.
There's
something I think is beautiful because he worries about her because she's being in jail, and he knows that he was driven to the situation by the boyfriend. So he was desperate because he was trying to protect his mother. And and Sue Ellen's trying to strongly protect him. Like, please don't mess with that. Let me resolve this. And she's desperate trying to protect him, and he's trying to protect her. There's a strong, you know, nowadays I said to Carolina that I think that the main character in the film is the relationship between this mother and the son, although it's a strongly conflicted relationship, but it's, I can see the love and the connection between both and the film, and I really think that this was our biggest achievement, you know, as actors, me and Kawan, to create this strong connection of love and hate, just as in real life, you know.
Absolutely.
Especially
and
having
I just
a teenager.
Well, I am in awe of your talent and your delivery and your performance in the film. I think it is top caliber. I'm very excited for you and your career because I think this we are going to be hearing a lot about you in the future.
Oh.
So I'm very excited about. I mean,
thank
you're
you
just
very much.
you're so authentic on the screen and you know I think that is going to be brilliant. I do want to pivot back to Carolina if I could because I want
of
to
course.
Ask. Yeah, thank you.
Thank
but
you,
congratulations.
Rob, and thank you to the audience, and thank you for your sensible and smart questions. Bye.
And thank you for being you. Thank you.
Hello again.
Hi. So Carolina, tell us what is the next steps for the film. You're doing how are the premieres going? You've already done one of them. What was the audience reaction?
It was very good. Actually, here we are having our U.S. premiere. The film premiered in September in Toronto. And the European premiere was in South by South, in San Sebastian, also in the previous year. And it was very good. I think the reactions were great. We got a lot of good reviews, so we are feeling very, very having this very warm welcome here in Austin. And tomorrow today we have our other screenings, 6:30 p.m. and 7 p.m. at Alamo Cinema, which is an amazing cinema. We are totally in love with it. And, yeah, we've been very well received here in Austin. We are very happy.
I'm not surprised that the reaction isn't great on this. What happens from here? Do you get distributors, though? How will people who are not going to film festivals be able to see not only this movie but your other work?
We are intending to get American distribution now. We are actually speaking to some distributors about it, and we are actually very eager to release the film here in theaters and in everything else after that. So now we are in this moment of speaking with distributors, but it is something that we really want the film to be spread here.
And I want to kind of pivot back to a little bit of what I was talking to Maeve about, but I wanted to get your perspective on it. You obviously wanted to make a very clear statement about homophobia in Brazil and the misguided attempts to change gay people. Tell me exactly what you feel about that and why you are making such a strong statement.
Well, actually, because we have a situation in Brazil in which the political figures that have a lot of power, that are very, very highly voted, they sometimes, the from the conservative parties, they treat the LGBT community with a lot of disrespect. You know, they say things that, you know, trying to be funny, and it's something really unbelievable. It's very ridiculous, and they are still taken seriously, which is difficult to understand. So my statement, I think, if there's one clear statement, let's say like that, it is to for us to think about how the hell these people are still being taken seriously, you know? How the hell do they get voted, you know? In Brazil, we have deputies that go to the Congress and started saying synonyms of the genitals, saying, you know, to disrespect the transgender community. We have a former minister of human rights that says that kids cannot have, like, frozen doll Elsa because she's a lesbian. I mean, all kinds of bizarreness that are treated seriously. I mean, it's a minister, it's deputies, it's congressmen, it's people that, you know, it's not clowns, supposedly. So, I mean, it's something that we should think about it. And other than that, I think that if a person has, like, the support inside of their own house, they are strong enough to deal with anything, you know. So this excuse that the mother doesn't want the son to be gay because it's difficult outside, it's something that we can't stand anymore, you know. I think I speak with a lot of people, and we speak a lot about this, you know, this part of the film, and I think it's something in common between a lot of cultures too. So I think it's a lot of things to think about, you know, and to respect the others the way they are.
Yeah, and I noticed in the film the even a lot of the things that would be LGBTQ oriented were very normal-ish. Like, for example, when Kwan's character is doing performing and with some makeup, he's not overt in big major drag. It's like it's actually kind of subtle. He's lip syncing, but not, you know, it's like he wouldn't necessarily even be considered a drag performer. Was that a choice to make it subtle in that way?
Definitely. I mean, she every sign of it already annoys her, you know, as if it was a disease that would be growing and getting more, you know, severe with the time, you know. So, I mean, he's a teenager, so there was this thing that she sees a sign, which for her is a sign of something that is not normative, not right, like he's doing these commercials for TikTok and being a bit flamboyant. This freaks her out, you know. So this is the choice that she's not even, you know, like, show off. He could be there, there would be no problem, of course, but the mother already is concerned about what's going on, what will go on, what will, you know, be even more show off, and as if it was a problem.
So Maeve talked about kind of learning from her fellow actor who lives the life like his character does, and how the scenes came out very organically between them, and you described that as well. Kind of now that you have the finished product and you are not only its creator but also its viewer, was there something or any nuances that you actually learned through this process of putting this together? What is your emotional takeaway on the subject now?
Well, I think just to be clear, it's not that he lives the life of the character. It's very different. I mean, he has a great, amazing, supportive mother, for instance. So, I mean, it's closer because he's a teenager. He has suffered some prejudice in real life and things like that. But it's not that he has experienced exactly the same things as the character, but he could bring a lot of things, him and his own mother, to us, for us to, in the film, you know, we learned a lot from them. I think all the film processes, they make you learn a lot as a filmmaker, you know, in terms of the whole process, and even the writing process, what, you know, ends up differently, and how things that feel wrong, they don't get good, and you need to change, you know. I always believe that films are very organic, so if you are in the set, for instance, and something isn't feeling, you know, the way that you thought it should feel, it probably won't be good on screen. So a lot of things that I think you get from experience, you know, and I don't think you should, as a filmmaker, be generous on yourself when you are looking at your own material. You should, even if you don't have a lot of time, think about changing something if you don't feel this is the right thing, the right feeling for the film.
But you created essentially a filmic essay around the subject that is poignant and, you know, moving, and really puts you as an audience member in the feet of each of the characters. I mean, it's like you're kind of going through it with them. What is your future sights set on thematically? What films do you want to make next? And even if you don't have a plot laid out for them, what themes are you looking to tackle in the next round?
Well, I'm always interested in absurd, which is quite close to normal nowadays, to social criticism, and I think, you know, to show some hypocrisies in society, I think this mainly is what interests me, you know, the dark humor tone mixed with drama, and, you know, this kind of weirdness is something that I enjoy watching, and I think you must try to do what you enjoy to see, what you enjoy to learn, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to see you make a film about the politician who is making fun of the Elsa doll. You know, there's got to be a backstory behind him. You know that. So, what else about the film that we haven't talked about do you want people to know about?
Well, I don't know if there's something that we won't spoil if we say here, but I would totally invite everyone to go see the film tonight here if you are in Austin, and I hope that the film gets distributed soon in the U.S. as well, so everyone could take a look, and I mean, I don't know if there's something specifically that we should... there's this thing about the city. It's placed in Cubatão, which is a very specific city. It's an industrial pole near São Paulo, and you need to go to pass there to go to the beachside, so you necessarily see the city when you go from São Paulo to the beachside, and it's a very interesting visual. It's very, you know, different, and it's very cinematic, in my opinion.
And one thing in the film that I found very fascinating, because it's not that it doesn't happen in the United States, but just it's the depiction seems so organic and natural, was kind of that organized crime element of with robbery and all that. Was that based on actual events in Brazil, or was that, again, just well-crafted imagination?
No, it's imagination. I mean, we do have a lot of organized crime and a lot of things like that, and unfortunately, including due to our social gaps that we have here. I mean, it's very... There are abysms, you know, in terms of classes here. Financially, it's very unequal, which generates a lot of violence always. But this thing that was created for the film, which I'm not going to say here, not to spoil, but this between the mother who works as a toll booth attendant and the boyfriend and this gang, let's say like that, this was something made up. This isn't something that I didn't, you know, I've never heard of.
so when you start hearing about it, you'll know they saw the film and thought, hey, that's a great idea.
I hope it doesn't inspire people.
we want to inspire them in different ways.
Absolutely
the conversion therapy, and I talked to Mav about this a little bit, was actually very authentic sounding, everything that you did. And she said that, you know, you had imagined up that scenario. What other research did you do in conversion therapy before creating that those scenarios?
Well, I did a lot of research. I went to some churches. I spoke with people that had, you know, that unfortunately been in this kind of thing. But it's pretty different, the kind of conversion therapy that we have in the film. I wasn't trying to portray the real violence, the real, you know, things that goes toward the LGBT community during a thing like that. I was trying to actually put light on how pathetic and how absurd it is someone to want to change anyone's sexual orientation and people who believe in something like that, you know. So my idea was trying to put light in the other side, you know, in how unbelievable to have someone who thinks he you know, could or should, you know, do something like that.
Right. Well, it was brilliant work. Thank you for being you. Thank you for your work and your message and you know, making a mark in the world on both the subject and the art form, just the experience of the characters you create and the environment and the effect that those have. So thank you for being you, and thank Ma for being her and her incredible talent. And thank you for joining us today, most importantly.
Thank you so much,
Rob.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for the talking. It was great.
Our pleasure. And great luck. I'm very excited for you for tonight and for the screenings of the film. If you are in the area there, please do check that out. If you're not in the area, keep your eyes peeled to the future when we will hopefully get this on a streaming platform or available for you to see. It is a must-see when you are able to take advantage of that. And that is
thank you
all
so
the
much.
Time we have for today. Oh, thank you. That's it for us for Rated LGBT Radio today. Don't forget to check out the Los Angeles Blade at losangelesblade.com. And we will be back here again next week with another exciting show. We will talk to you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.